Hello and welcome back to the podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Geraldine Myrna. And Geraldine's a colleague of mine in the Literacy Development Centre. And in this episode, we're talking about the myth of meritocracy. So Geraldine first explains what meritocracy is, and then we discuss how this myth persists in our education system. This was a really fascinating conversation for me, so I hope you enjoy it as well. So welcome back, Geraldine. I'm delighted to have you back again. And we're going to talk about meritocracy today. So I'll start and ask you, what is meritocracy?
Okay, well, I suppose the simplest understanding that I have, and again, I'm talking about it as an adult educator, really, is that it perpetuates this idea that if we have talent and we work hard, that we will achieve, you know, that we will gain merit, if you like, through these two principles. And I suppose it's a very simple idea, but when I was introduced to it, which is a long time ago now, it really struck a chord with me because I realized that I had never really questioned that idea that if you work hard and you've got any kind of talent at all, that you will achieve. And I suppose we have to look at what achievement means within the idea of meritocracy. And again, we're looking at really a triangular shaped society with, you know, people on the bottom. And when I mean people on the bottom, I mean, you know, the people who are on the lower socioeconomic brackets are those who have less status in their occupations and are less well paid. And that as you move up to the top, you have more status and you have more pay and more recognition for the work that you do. So I suppose if that's the model that's underpinning this, it brings you back to that idea and you say, well, how do you decide who has merit and who hasn't got merit? And I think that's the really interesting question, Karen. You know, I mean, as adult educators, when we're in classrooms, we're making all kinds of judgments about what is achievement, what is success, what is merit. Oh, I suppose that's the next bit. Would you like me to talk a little bit about the whole idea of merit then and how that's worked out within the meritocratic idea?
Yeah, because I think that's really interesting for education, because I know I've had those discussions with students in the classroom. We talk about teaching methodologies or different types of schooling systems. And one of the questions I get asked, but are they successful? And I always come back to the question, it depends on what do you mean by success?
Yeah.
So well, I'd like to get into that with you.
Yeah, because I suppose, I mean, the idea has been around for a long time, but I'm going to go back and I'm going to talk to you really about Michael Dunlop-Young, because he satirized this whole idea of meritocracy. Yeah. And in that sense, it very much merit depends on believing that there are these kind of standardized tests and that there is a system of being able to put people into an open and fair competition. Yeah. And you subject them to this standardized exam. And again, it's obsessed with counting and quantifying. And then on the basis of your talent, your hard work, that the outcome fairly much predicts, you know, who is worthy of the most merit, who is worthy of the least merit. And I suppose in that, I have to acknowledge, you know, that there's a place for examining certain areas of knowledge and finding out who's very skilled, who's very competent in an area. But the problem is that when this gets tied into our education system, it becomes a very sweeping statement about what success might mean and who's worthy of advancing up through society or gaining recognition or gaining status. And it comes back very much to that experience of, you know, having achieved these credentials through the exam system. And I suppose that's where I want to open it up in terms of why this might be of interest to our tutors and our students. Does that ring any bells with you, Karen, that very narrow
Absolutely.
Definition?
I can see how it's taken hold and it does sound reasonable. I suppose this whole democracies and countries built on that premise that you can be whatever you want to be.
Yeah.
If you just work hard enough at it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, while I think it's that double-edged sword, isn't it? Because like when we're with our students, we want them to believe in their potential. But I think we really have to examine some of how they have internalized those ideas about meritocracy, which now work against them when they're back in the classroom again. And I think the downside of meritocracy really, I mean, is that it doesn't allow for the fact that we have huge differences of opportunity and equality between people, you know, and it, to me, it skews our view of the world and of people, because you come out with this idea that people make their own luck. And I think that's the part of it that I find myself most at odds with, is that idea that if you succeed, it's because you've worked hard, you know, you've applied yourself, and you single-handedly deserve that success. The other side of it is that the people who don't succeed then become the failures. I can't remember when in our house I heard my kids starting to talk about losers. Was it Bart Simpson or something that brought up this idea of losers? You know, but there was this idea going around about people being losers, which I had never heard of before, you know, and I do think it brings a lack of compassion.
You're a Bart Simpson person.
Yeah. No, my house is, yeah.
Yeah, no, and it's, I mean, you know, God, we've enjoyed many of Bart Simpson. But that worries me, because if you look at that in our classroom, I think we see that playing out, that people come back and they really have internalized this idea that they themselves single-handedly have failed. You hear all these excuses, you know, like, oh, I was a messer, I didn't work hard. And I think so much of our job, our central job, to me, our central job is to go back and to examine those questions about why you didn't succeed and where the responsibility is, you know?
And I see now, like with my own children, you know, those excuses that we make as adults, I was a messer, I wasn't really very good at school, or I wasn't engaged, I spent most of my time daydreaming. Yes. And when I see that now with my children, I think, well, usually there's a reason, there's other things going on. It's not as simple as self-blame.
Yeah. No. And I think that self-blame is very dangerous, because then what you do is you sort of, it gets in the way of believing in yourself, that you know, in a classroom you can expect to succeed, you can expect to turn around that experience and have the opposite of it, you know. And meritocracy, it works on the basis that we have this fair education system that everybody gets access to. You know, the teachers are all trained, you know, in a standardized way. We've got a standardized curriculum, we've got standardized tests, you know, all the exams happen on the same day all around the country. So it's very simple to really take it at face value. But I think in each of those issues that we've talked about, teacher training, curriculum, assessment, it's part of our job to unpick that with students and for them to understand how they're very complex concepts, and that learners need to understand that, you know, teachers have a responsibility to help them to learn, you know, and that assessment isn't always the best measure of their progress. You know, that curriculums, if they're disembodied and, you know, can decontextualize things that we're not interested in, then we're not going to learn. So at every turn in the classroom, I think we have to be aware, constantly aware, of trying to represent who we are and what we're doing in a way that makes it truly learner-centered, you know, and challenges some of those prevailing ideas about, you know, mainstream dominant models of teaching and learning.
Yeah. And do you think, Geraldine, that in some ways in adult literacy, the tutors get that? Because I know adult literacy tutors spend a lot of time with students who believe that they have failed in the system. Yeah.
I think probably the idea that we were most comfortable and familiar with was the idea that we were going to help learners to tell their stories, and that there was a lot of value put on hearing learners where they could tell us about their stories. And so all that idea of language experience, which has become something else in many ways now, language experience is being taken up just as a way of reinforcing technical aspects of literacy, you know, grammar, spelling. But the whole idea of language experience was really getting people to get their stories done and to put a value on their story and to start reframing their experiences, you know. And we in literacy see that as central, that we start by finding out what might be those internalized messages about teaching and about learning that have let the student down the first time around, that they need to challenge if they're going to go forward. So it's very important within literacy, but I feel it's important throughout the whole adult and further education sector. The other thing that it strikes me about that we do in adult literacy as well is that we really do make a strong effort to look at different values other than the values of competing against other people in a kind of a you know, standardized test. We have other definitions of success. And I think that whole thing of building relationships and bringing collaboration and sharing and, you know, recognizing we can learn with each other is something that we really prize as being very, very important. And therefore being a good learner with other learners and helping other people to learn, being able to participate in groups and discussion, value that so highly. And yet that isn't tested or measured. So we do turn on our head the idea of success, you know, and I think we also bring compassion in, because we're constantly trying to understand people's story against the circumstances of their lives, which may have got in the way of them being able to achieve what they would have liked to have achieved. You know, I mean, bad luck, circumstances of your birth, there's no end to how we really can't stand on our high horse and claim our successes, because it's so random how things are distributed to people, you know. One of the biggest failures that a child commits is to be born into a poor family. And I'm saying that very carefully because, you know, I didn't come from a wealthy family myself. It was a very loving family, a terrific family in every sense. But in terms of trying to level a playing pitch of opportunities that are open to you. Because I suppose what we haven't talked about, Karen, is we haven't talked about the whole high status of a college degree, because that's become the kind of meritocratic building brick now. And when you think about it, how narrow that is, so many occupations, so many qualities of person that we need in our society, so many forms of success will never be captured in a college degree, you know?
Yeah, because one of the myths I want to explore with you is the ideas of what constitutes success and achievement are bound up in cultural assumptions.
Yes.
And just one example that came to mind when you were talking earlier about testing is, I mean, IQs, and we think of IQs as fairly standardized tests that give you a good indication of how intelligent somebody is. These tests were developed for predominantly white populations. They're the populations that are more likely to be successful in those tests. So there's cultural context to all of that.
Yeah, and that cultural bias. It's funny, it really struck me when my eldest child was about, I don't know, about 17 months. You know, the way you get a developmental test.
Oh, yeah,
and,
yeah.
There were a number of things, you know, but the thing that stood out to me was they started the first line of a nursery rhyme and she was able to finish them. But that was a product of her being born into the culture that she was born into, because I, you know, coming from a whole literacy background, I really valued pre-literacy work. I would have valued nursery rhymes. She was exposed to that. Yeah. Whereas you could have had another child in another family, they just didn't do nursery rhymes for any reason. It might be part of that.
Or different nursery rhymes, yeah.
Yeah, based on songs and just not this very standard Western, traditional kind of middle class nursery rhyme. And it struck me how arbitrary that was to make a decision about her, you know, conceptual development based on being incomplete. You know, do you know that sort of cultural bias? So I completely agree with you. I think the whole thing of IQ, and it's coming back into schools now, you know, with more standardized testing, looking at what's happening in the UK, and that really worries me, because how do we reward students if ultimately we're trying to measure something as wide and broad as being a human being and all the potentials that they have on a very narrow, you know, and culturally biased IQ scale. I suppose that shadow side of meritocracy, the good thing about the COVID pandemic is it has raised real questions about what occupations we value, what competencies we value. And I think things like kindness, you know, the supermarket cashiers and shelf stackers. And suddenly there was a different conversation about what was a valuable occupation. But the problem is that, you know, the reward and the status for those jobs remains still appallingly low, you know, in terms of benefits. And it brings you right into that thing, doesn't it? About the divide with women and homemakers, you know, at the moment. It's just an unequal divide. And again, it's the lack of recognition, the lack of sense of achievement or progress if you're at home managing a home, managing children, you know, that's never going to add up to your college degree. I think that is linked into the whole idea of meritocracy, because while if you work hard at your college degree, you know, you are, there are still all those random and disparate, it just automatically transfer into, you know, a high status job or a well paid job. I'm not suggesting that. But you can spend your whole life growing human beings, taking care of elderly people, building up your neighborhood, enriching your community, changing lives is not considered to be high status work worthy of the kind of merit that advances you up through, you know, up through the socioeconomic groups.
And all of the people who do end up in high status jobs, think of all of the care work that went on behind those people to allow them to study, to get their qualifications, to go out and do the work required to get them to that status. It requires a lot of care.
Yeah, very often you find in those situations as well, Karen, like that, you know, because if you've got two people of very, very high status and high occupational, you know, demands and well rewarded, as soon as children come along, very often one person will have to stay. It's not possible for two people always, you know, or it's very difficult for two people to continue to work at that level. Well, and all that can be worked out between couples. I'm not passing any judgment on any of that, but it's just that the person who chooses to do the home making and the home caring is the person inevitably who starts to drop in terms of, you know, their status, how they'll be rewarded, how they can, you know, progress back in the work world again. And it's the shadow side, really, of having such a narrow measurement system for merit.
So I know you were telling me there that you grew up in the UK, so you're well aware of the effects of the meritocratic system in education.
Yeah. I left in 71, and it was the first year that the 11 plus had been done away with, and it was replaced by school-based competency. And I suppose this is where, you know, Michael Dunlop Young was coming from when he was saying that what it does is at a very young age, it gives people the idea, you know, that they are people who have the potential for achieving great merit. So the streaming system kicks in very tightly, and you've got this kind of tripartite system where at 11, you've got the whole destinies of children going on to grammar school who are seen as the leaders. And then there was the comprehensive, which was the more modern mixed progressive school, the middle of the road. And then there was the secondary modern. And I remember, I suppose this is a very important story for me, because I remember my sister, who was very bright, you know, like there's no question, but she was much brighter than me. But she had a really rough time in school for various reasons. And at the end of her 11 plus failed it, and was put into the third tier of the tripartite system and at the very bottom stream. There were about 13 streams. She was at the very bottom stream. And I know how personally she carried that sense of failure. And it was fantastic when she had reared her children. She went back on an access program in WIT and she did a degree and she went on to get first class honours and a master's. But I'll never forget when she got the results from her degree and she got first class honours. And I just said, Eileen, that's, you know, listen, it's brilliant. It's fantastic. That has to put to bed, you know, all those doubts you've harboured about yourself all those years. And all she said was, her very words were, I couldn't have got that. They must have made a mistake. Or their standards must be really low. You know, it still popped up into her head, you know. So I suppose that's why I've been so passionate.
And I had a student talk about the very same experience as Eileen's in class one day. She mentioned she'd failed her 11 plus and she was put into a lower stream and her brother got to go into grammar school. Yeah. And even though, I mean, she was one of my top students, she was a fantastic student, bright academic, wonderful teacher herself, is very capable and competent. She still carries that with her.
Yeah,
all of these
it doesn't
years.
Go. And I think that's maybe one of the strengths of the adult further education, particularly with literacy students, is that we're very aware if someone's not succeeding, we need to have a conversation with them. We need to try and find out what internally is going on in their heads or their hearts that's creating the kinds of anxieties and stresses and strains that's getting in the way of them from being able to achieve. And then you can start talking about finding ways that they might learn differently or finding other ways of doing things. But I think we have to tackle those internal messages when appropriate, when they arise, you know?
Yeah.
Because without doing that, I think the student is working against really their better self. There's a kind of like a ceiling around them, you know, that has to be challenged.
And I was wondering, what are your thoughts on, like, I have students or tutors in my class who they get the myth of meritocracy and they recognise that a lot of what they do, the valuable work they do in class, is not the measurable stuff, but they feel like they're constantly struggling in a system that, because even further education now is becoming more assessment based and accredited programmes are being pushed more and more. And I think they're just struggling that sometimes that they're pushing their learners into that.
You know, I think nobody's against people achieving and succeeding and doing well in exams. You know, that's what we're here for. We want that. But the understanding that that doesn't automatically mean that you're going to map into a good, well-paid job. Because as we know from a kind of sociological perspective, there are all kinds of other circumstances. You know, your ability to network, the kinds of you know, cultural capital, as Bourdieu would say, that you have coming into those situations. So it doesn't automatically, I mean, that's the other myth about it, you know, that just because you've worked hard and you're talented and you've done really well, that the jobs are going to be, you know, you're going to walk into this great job for all kinds of reasons. You know, jobs are disappearing, they're being replaced by other jobs. So, you know, what you're qualified for can change and what you're qualified for might not be valued within your culture. But I think the other point around that is this polarized view of one or the other, you know, that we have to compromise on all of the things that build learners' capacities by building their beliefs in themselves, by helping them to build good learning relationships with us and other students in the classroom, and by acknowledging other forms of success. And that's on one side of the dichotomy. And then on the other, the extreme other side of it is, you know, the only thing that's valuable is measurable learning. And I think the way forward, and this is in theory, because I think in practice this is very difficult to do, but I think part of what we've got to do, our argument going forward, is to show that they are not actually in opposition with each other. That if we want students to do well in standardized performance testing or in competency-based testing, that it's in their interest that we bring a richer, broader view of learning, a broader view of success, and look at the values that underpin that into the classroom. Because, you know, acknowledging all those other dimensions to learning that we're talking about, you know, the emotional, the social, the psychological, the sociological, in terms of understanding your place in society. When all that is taken into the package, it has to work to the benefit of the students trying to progress with other, you know, more objective types of knowledge that you can measure. Yeah. But the difficulty is trying to do that, because I know when I have these conversations with tutors, they're saying, but that takes time, you know, it's invisible, nobody sees it, nobody wants to give time for it. And that's where it becomes very, very difficult, you know. And I think part of our work as adult educators is to try and bring that conversation everywhere we need to, you know, that the other forms of success, and, you know, if you want to talk about the effective domain, taking care of our learners, that this is absolutely essential for good learning to take place. And if they're missing, for some learners, not for all learners, but for some learners, and particularly the learners we're dealing with, if that's not there, we're at nothing anyway, you know. People are just doing this shallow form of rote learning, getting through, and nothing ultimately has changed for them, you know.
I think it just gives people food for thought that we need to look at this system that we're in.
Yes. And I think be mindful in our classrooms that we have huge agency to recreate a system which takes on board values, which really honours the range of abilities and the range of ways that learners can achieve and succeed in our classrooms.
So, Geraldine, what links do you see between meritocracy and transformational learning?
Well, that's a really good question, Carolyn. And I probably, I suppose, if you talk about transformative learning, we could have a whole other chat. But I see really close links between them. And I think it's because when I started to really examine my understanding of transformative learning, because it's a term we use a lot, and it's easy to feel like, of course, we're transforming lives of students. But I suppose I've really paused and asked myself that question over the last number of years. What is it that we're trying to change? Exactly what is it that we're trying to change? And I suppose following on from that is, and what have we got permission to change? You know, like, we can't just have agendas that we bring into our classroom about what we feel is important to change without involving and negotiating that with our students. And in the same way, they need to negotiate that with the students. I think it's really worthwhile for every tutor to stand back and just ask that question, what is it that I'm trying to change? And I think that's where transformative learning is very helpful, but also quite baffling and quite broad, because I suppose in transformative learning, we're very connected to the idea that we really want to change something that is very deep and important within the lives of people, that we're really trying to give people more control of their lives at one end, and that we're also trying to help them to reach potential, but also it would be within our belief that we're trying to change the very structures that create the inequality and that create this very unfair and two-tier system that we have within our society. So it's a very broad spectrum of change that you're talking about there.
Yeah, and then how do you think, how do we do this?
Yeah, well, I love that question, Karen, because I have to say, you know, I would have been very Freirean at the start, and I worked in a community-based context, and the whole quest of transformation was agreed. We were out to change the structures or the barriers, as we probably call them in the classroom, the barriers that got in the way of that group of women being able to ever even see their potential, so less grow into it. And we would have worked collectively towards identifying those. So our first project, for example, would have been like setting up daycare for their children so that they could be released to come to study. So it was a very straightforward answer to the question. Whereas when we're working within the LDC, you know, we're working with tutors who are working with students, but I do think, and this is where I see the meritocracy, one thing that we have to radically change, and it does involve a complete radical repositioning of our understanding of the role of a teacher, the role of the learner, and our understanding of knowledge, who generates it, what knowledge is valued, what knowledge is important. To bring it back to meritocracy, I think that really meritocracy is about helping people to challenge those stories about their learning journey that they have internalized through the system. And I think that's probably the biggest barrier for some people, certainly for those who have gained the least from the system and who have been dramatically failed by the system. I really feel that the starting point of transformation is to start retelling that story and to start realizing that they are not the failures, that they have been failed. And I feel in one sentence, that is what meritocracy can bring into our classrooms, that all those ideas about if you work hard, if you've a bit of talent, i.e. you'll succeed, because the opposite message is an enormous barrier. If it's like, well, you must have no talent or you didn't work hard because you're a loser. And I don't know, I feel a real passion when I go into a classroom to root that out, because in my experience, those moments when students begin to see that they can learn, they have opinions, it's absolute fireworks in my head. And I think the damage of meritocracy is that story of meritocracy is one we have to root it out at every opportunity.
I talk about this in terms of, I talk about agency in my classes all the time with students. We're very critical of the education system. And sometimes it can leave students, which are tutors, feeling very powerless because they say, well, yeah, it's all well and good critiquing the system, but I still have to work within it. So usually I like to always come back to in class, well, what do we have the power to do within? Because you mentioned earlier, we have enormous power within our classrooms and enormous agency.
That is fabulous, Karen. I love that because you're so right. You know, it's great to go in with all these ideologies in our head,
yeah,
but we're serving nobody any benefit if we're making people angry and frustrated but powerless. So I love that responsibility of showing people how to harness their anger in a very constructive way, you know.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a great line to finish up on, so thank you.